The winner. We're announcing the winner of the raffle.
Steven Swanson in Salt Lake City.
Hey, that's me hiding out here.
Ah,
cool. Excellent.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome, mate. You're most welcome.
Know what to do with the oils?
I have quite a collection of essential oils already, and I'll be making some wet method ormus with those and experimenting many other ways, I'm sure.
One of my favorite ways with essential oils is you take some fresh water, mix in about 2 teaspoons of your favorite salt, put the essential oil on top and shake it vigorously, then put it in a warm incubator for 6 weeks, and the ormus will drop out of the oil into the salt and settle to the bottom.
Is there a link to that?
No.
It sounded pretty good.
I wrote it long time ago on the ormus list.
So the people who listen to this conference call can hear it again. Just tell it again, Michael.
Oh, okay. I take normal fresh spring water. Thankfully, in Australia, we've got some wonderful springs, and some are really quite close to me. I prefer spring water or natural spring water over deionized or distilled water, mainly because I'm not terribly happy with the way distilled water tends to work. You grab that normal water, you add about 2 teaspoons of salt to 500 milliliters of water, stir it up, put the essential oil on top, put your hand over the flask or...
How much essential oil?
Fill the flask in some manner. Yeah, oil and water won't mix, as most people will know. But the salt in the water will leach the ormus out of the oil. So you basically put your hand over the top of the flask or fill the flask in some manner, give it a good shake, and then stick it in a incubator, which in my house is just a bucket full of sand with a heater in the bottom of it. I just bury it in the sand, keep it warm for about 6 weeks, and you'll get a brownish-looking, fluffy white precipitate, which will fall to the bottom, depending on what oil you use. I prefer to use Mir.
What kind do you prefer to use?
Mir, M-Y-R-R-H. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Mir.
No.
Oh, there you go. Different people pronounce it differently.
But that's how we say it in New Jersey.
And how much essential oil do you use, Michael?
Well, I get 15 mils for $75, which is rather expensive.
And how much of that do you use?
I use
it all. You use the whole lot, okay.
Once it does drop out in the brown precipitate, you separate the water from the precipitate. I generally put the precipitate back into a test tube and bury it back in the incubator and leave it for a good 3 to 4 months, and it will turn white.
What sort of salt do you like to use?
I prefer Horizon salt or Sanders Atlantic salt.
Both are generally Celtic sea salts, right?
Yeah, a generally good sea salt. Though Horizon salt is actually an inland salt, that's my preference at the moment.
And that's an indigenous
Australian
salt.
That's an Aussie salt.
Yeah, it is an Australian salt. It doesn't grow cubic like most salt crystals will. It actually grows in a pyramid shape.
It's quite neat salt, actually.
It's very unique.
That's Sanders, you said?
No, Horizon.
Oh, okay.
If you guys want
you
the good thing, just look up
Horizon
salt on the web, and you better order some.
Michael, what temperature do you use on your heater on the incubator?
I prefer 37.5.
Okay.
That's degrees Celsius.
So the question is, how do you get it to that temperature stably, Michael?
My heater element has got a dial on it that you can control. It's digital. It costs a little bit of money, and it will keep the sand quite warm like that for days and days and days on end.
Okay.
Just to confirm, Michael, that's body temperature, isn't it?
Correct. Most things will ferment at body temperature. In fact, just about everything will ferment at body temperature.
So we could be a walking fermentation.
You are, yes.
And some of us are.
Yeah, you're all the warmest incubators.
Yeah. Keep it under your arm and you'll be fine. So listen, I'm just going to pick up the call and mute the room. And if you want to ask any questions, hit *7 to unmute yourself. And because it doesn't mean when I hit 00 as a moderator that you can't ask questions. You can just hit *7 and type right up.
So Michael.
Well, I'll if everyone can still hear me, and we should get started, considering we're already pretty much running late. Thanks for everyone for attending the call. My name is Michael Burberry. I live in the western suburbs of Sydney near the Blue Mountains. Up in the Blue Mountains, there are many freshwater streams and many springs. I generally do go up into the mountains to prepare quite a few of my works, and before coming home to complete them. I first started with alchemy many years ago. I was very much a vegetarian herbal alchemist. I made plant stones and spagyric plant tinctures. I did that for many years, and in about August of 2005, I stumbled across Barry's site. Before even attending any of the Yahoo groups, I basically pinched quite a bit from Barry's site and proceeded to do that myself. I started with the salt method. I then moved on with the hydrochloric acid and hydrogen peroxide methods and kept moving on since then, doing many other different methods. I take daily ormus every day. Every morning that I get up, it's now a ritual for me. So that 16 months I have been having regular ormus for. In that time, there has been many changes to myself. I was not very well for many years. I was lactose intolerant, that I am not anymore. I had several broken bones that caused me pain on a regular basis, of which none of causing me any further pain. My left foot, I had a motorcycle accident. I had 15 fractures in my left foot. My doctors were telling me I probably never would walk on it properly again. And as Dennis can attest, I can walk on it quite happily now. Other things is my cat is now 18 years old and still runs around and chases mice. She gets her share as well. And yes, I know. And my family all have their share as well. I make enough for my family, for my children, and for my lovely wife. We have all been having ormus now for the better part of a year. We are all very healthy. We get sick very seldom. In fact, I can't even remember the last time I had the flu. That's some of the things that have happened to myself and my family. I've also recommended a lot of my friends, particularly towards Sigverta, and some of them have purchased products from Sigverta. One of the gentlemen, he had a lot of problems with concentration. He was easily distracted. He's finding that since he's started on Sigverta's products that his concentration is a lot better than what it used to be. So he is thinking a lot better now. And just to show you how much that has improved, he's had several promotions now at the place that we work. And he's now one of the board of directors. So he's actually doing quite well for himself. And I'm sure he will thank Sigverta if he gets a chance. Other of my friends, I went for quite a while to a tarot card reader, lovely lady who taught me how to read tarot cards. Then I switched to the Egyptian rune cards, which were much better. I introduced her to Ormus as well, and she left the practice of tarot card readings, and she's now a priest at a local church. So that changed her quite a bit as well. Moving on then, the second thing Dennis would like me to talk about are some of the methods that I use. I quite like doing the salt precipitation methods. I think the best salt at this stage, I'd still have to say, is the Horizon salt. You get plenty of precipitate from it, and it's actually very light, is probably the best word I can put to it. If you allow it to settle for several days, it does compress quite well, which makes it easy to separate the water, after which I generally add some distilled white vinegar to redissolve it, and then precipitate it again at a pH of 9.2. That tends to remove most of the magnesium and calcium from it as well, and the precipitant comes out very translucent. You can almost see through it as it drops out, and that one is actually very nice. I have also done the hydrochloric acid and hydrogen peroxide method with several metals.
Excuse me a second.
The only metal I found so far that it doesn't tend to work with is lead, though I found a different method with lead, which actually worked quite well.
You wanted to ask a question?
Yes,
sorry?
Michael. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
How much precipitate do you get after you've cleaned it?
Out of a kilo of salt, I get about 100 grams.
Okay,
so
and
about
how much before you clean it do you get?
Before I re-precipitate it with the...
Right.
Okay. In that case, yes, it's about one-tenth, about 100 grams per kilo of salt. But after I redissolve it in distilled white vinegar and then precipitate it again, it's about half again.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing
amount.
Yeah,
so it would come out at probably just under 50 grams.
Excellent.
It's still quite a lot.
Yes, so Horizon salt is actually extremely good. I've found it better than most other salts. The other one I quite like is the Sanders Atlantic sea salt. They call it a fine organic sea salt. So basically they've just dug it up from a salt marsh. I mean, there's nothing special there. They've basically just gone and they're selling it. And it's actually quite cheap.
Is that 50 grams wet? 50 grams wet or dry?
No, that
your yield is?
Yeah, that would be dry.
Okay.
Well, it's even better.
Yep, with the Sanders salt, the precipitate isn't as bright white as Horizon salt. It's actually a bit more yellowish. And when you re-precipitate that through distilled vinegar, it does go slightly translucent, but it does keep its yellowish tinge to it. It's not quite as good as the Horizon, in my opinion, but I found the plants like it. The plants really do like that one. They don't tend to like the Horizon one as much as they do the Atlantic sea salt. From my research, I found that Atlantic sea salt from specific areas contain 86 mineral elements. I would have to say that after this type of procedure, at least 60 of those mineral elements would still be there, and that would also include selenium. That's my belief of why the Atlantic one goes a slight yellowish tinge. That's the selenium. As soon as any selenium is exposed to oxygen, be it in water or not, it does go yellowish and then will go brown afterwards, much like an apple does when you crack an apple open. It will tarnish and go brown. That's the selenium mineral in the apple as well.
Now, just before I cut myself off, I was about to announce Michael and his credentials, and I'm just reminding you guys that Michael is trained as an industrial chemist because his family had a an electroplating business, and so Michael's got this chemistry wired in his brain, And, you know, so he has somewhat of an advantage over most of the list in that most of us don't have this extraordinary chemistry background. And Michael just then got bored with it and went into being a computer genius and makes
well,
his money that way.
But
he still has his whole background. What's that, mate?
There was a period in between as well.
Oh, yeah,
I was
a
marine
that.
Mechanic for a while as well.
What's that?
Oh, okay. After I finished the industrial chemistry course, I was in electroplating for 7 years, working there. Prior to that, yes, I used to go with my dad all the time to his factory and actually work in the electroplating factory. But after 7 years of electroplating, I left the electroplating scene and went back to university full-time and studied automotive engineering in marine technology and then worked at a boatyard for 3 years, actually working on basically diesel generators and things inside a yacht, which was interesting.
So how did you get from being a boatie to being way out in the western suburbs of Sydney in the foot of the mountain?
Well, it actually was a motorcycle accident. I love motorcycles. I've still got two. They're sitting next to me here in the garage. One's a Harley, the other one's a Ducati. Yes, I had a fairly bad accident on the motorcycle, and I couldn't work as a marine engineer anymore because I was sort of bound to a wheelchair. So I went back to university and studied electrical engineering in computer technology and design, and then specialized in robotics, and specifically programming of robotics. And then I was very lucky one day that a job came up and I started working in the computer industry, mainly just on the phone and testing, and worked up from there because I was quite capable of programming. These days I'm working for GE Finance, General Electric.
Now what do you do, what do you do with them?
Well, what I can tell you, because they like to keep things rather secret, what I can tell you is I am a programmer for them. I'm the third-tier engineer, which means when a problem is raised with a particular program, the buck stops with me. It can't go any further. So first-tier engineers attempt to resolve it. If they can't, it goes to second-tier, who collect all the information, and then it comes to me to actually fix. The programs are very much financial programs. GE is probably one of the biggest lenders in the world. In fact, I think they are the biggest lender in the world. The programs that calculate interest and transport data between banks and other people and businesses and so on, generally through encrypted channels, generally over the internet as well. Those types of programs are all written by myself.
Wow.
So with that high level of computer expertise, one of the things you told me is it gives you a good ability to sniff. In most
yes.
places, you're interested in sniffing.
Yes, I'm. I guess you could say that since I have broad experience in computer technology, I'm able to dig up information that most people wouldn't know how to dig up. And I think that also comes from having worked with databases for many years. I know how databases think, so I know how to structure queries in a manner that I can find the information I'm looking for.
So that makes you a sleuth.
In a manner of speaking.
Yeah.
So you started to tell us about another method that you had.
Oh, there's so many. What particular one, with salt or with metal, or what would
well,
you like
you
to start with?
You started to tell us about another one when I interrupted with my last question.
Okay. I quite prefer the hydrochloric acid and hydrogen peroxide method.
Oh, that's very nice. That's the method that I came up with.
Yes. I was wondering who came up with that one. I have found that one to work on just about the vast majority of metals that I've worked with, including tin, molybdenum, which is what coins are made of, That it works particularly well with them, but it doesn't work very well with lead or bismuth or antimony. It works somewhat well with mercury. With those different metals where the hydrogen peroxide just doesn't seem to attack it very well, I actually place the metal in the water connected to the anode of the battery, and I actually disassociate the metal into the hydrochloric acid through electrolysis. And that one tends to work quite well for pretty much any metal.
Oh, wow.
Michael, would you give us a quick step-by-step run-through of that process? It can be quick because people can record this call and just go through it step-by-step at their own leisure.
Well, one of the first steps of processing any particular metal is to get the metal down into its chloride form. Once you disassociate the metal down into its chloride form, then particularly if you haven't used other acids like nitric or sulfuric, such as what other people tend to recommend that I don't particularly like. But once you do get the metal down into a chloride form, it's a matter
of... How do you do that?
The most efficient method is with hydrogen peroxide. But like I said, hydrogen peroxide doesn't work on all metals. It does work particularly well with gold and silver and all the platinum group metals. But when you start getting into the higher density, softer metals like lead and bismuth, it just doesn't seem to work well at all. For those metals, I generally hook them up to a car battery and dip them into a hydrochloric acid solution where the cathode is a titanium strip and the anode is the actual metal itself that you are disassociating. And it does plate some of the metal onto the titanium strip, but that's easily cleaned off. But the rest of the metal ions that break loose through the electrolysis method actually do end up turning into a chloride in the solution. And then it's a matter of just filtering the solution, and you have your chloride solution ready to keep going.
And how do you filter it?
I generally filter it through coffee filters, or if my wife permits me, I use an old silk lady's stocking folded over many times, which actually works better. I know, it's funny, but it actually works very well. The woven silk stockings, the fibers are very close together, and fold that over about 10 times and run the solution through that, and not much else gets through. Just the chloride solution will get through.
And then you've got this stuff you've just filtered, and what do you do with that?
Okay, once you've got the metal into its chloride form, the best method I found is you put it on an element set to about 50 degrees Celsius, so it's not boiling temperature, but it's enough to make it slightly steamed, and you leave it there for at least 4 to 5 days and let it steam off, and it actually slowly evaporates down. And when you've evaporated down about two-thirds of the way, I then top it up with more hydrochloric acid and repeat that process. I then repeat that process 4 or 5 times and then top it up with hydrochloric acid again and then start adding the sodium hydroxide to precipitate out the metals.
And what strength is the hydrochloric acid?
Sorry?
And what strength is the hydrochloric acid?
The one I use is 70%.
Okay.
I get it from an electroplating factory.
Yeah.
Okay, if you get the pool grade one, that's generally 35%. With the pool grade hydrochloric acid that you can get from pool shops, well, some if they still sell it, that particular acid you need to actually run the procedure through a lot more times before it will successfully work. It's better with a stronger acid, but you need to be careful and wear gloves, etc.
Now, are you exposing this hydrochloric acid to sunlight?
Yes, that's one of the tricks I like to do before starting with the hydrogen peroxide. I take my 70% hydrochloric acid, I put it in an Erlenmeyer flask, fill the flask and put it up on the roof, on a little table I got up there on the roof, and leave it out in the sunlight from dawn to dusk. When you actually look at it doing this process, it sweats. You can actually see the hydrochloric acid sweating.
and the vapors rise up towards the seal and then drip back down into the acid. And it makes the acid rather much stronger for some reason I haven't yet worked out. I'm really not sure why that works. It just does. And then you end up using a lot less. Sorry?
Stronger in what way?
Okay, it's more reactive. If you grab normal hydrochloric acid and you put your gold in it, for instance, and then you start dripping in your hydrogen peroxide, you'll be dripping it in for a good 10, 15 minutes before you even start to see it bubbling and breaking down the gold. But if you grab the hydrochloric acid and you solarize it for a whole day, you start dripping in your hydrogen peroxide within 2 to 3 minutes, you'll start seeing it bubble and breaking down the gold. It's much faster.
And when you break down the gold, is it powdered gold or nuggets or what?
Oh, yeah, it's just filed down gold coins. That's what I use. I just use a nail file and file down the gold coin into a dust and just pour the dust into the flask.
Ah.
It's quite simple. Nothing special there. I know some people like to beat the gold into small gold flakes and just drop the flakes in. I mean, that's probably just as successful, but I find using a small nail file and just nail file down the coin, it's actually quite effective. Takes a while, but quite effective.
So now you've got the gold chloride, and
yep.
you've filtered it.
Yes.
Where are you
and
going
you,
from
you
there?
You boil it down.
Yeah.
Actually, but not boil it. I like to just steam it down. So I set the element to about 50 degrees Celsius, which
yeah.
is enough to warm it enough that it starts to steam off. And it takes several days to steam it down to about one-third its volume.
Okay.
And then you top it up and you do it again, and then top it up and do it again. You do that at least 3 to 4 times. Sometimes you need to do it 5 times. It depends on the next stage. Because on the next stage, you start adding small amounts of sodium hydroxide to raise the pH of the solution up. You need to actually do that very slowly because this is actually a very reactive acid, and it gets very hot very quickly when you do start putting in sodium hydroxide. So you do need to be quite careful with that one, particularly with the Pyrex glass flask. They tend to shatter quite easily if you put it in too fast. I'm sure Sigfurt has probably shattered a few.
Yeah, I've blown quite a few things up.
So anyway, you drop the sodium hydroxide. I generally like to take about three nights actually slowly dripping in to bring up the pH. I like to bring up the pH to about 11 or 12 to get all the precipitate to drop out. And at that point, if the precipitate has black pieces in it or is a darkish grey, you actually need to start again. You actually need to, like, filter off all the hydrochloric acid so you're left with just the precipitate, top it up with fresh solarized hydrochloric acid and start with your hydrogen peroxide again and break it all down again. You know when you got it right because the precipitate will be a snow white. I mean, it is really snow white. If it's not snow white, start again. Okay?
If it's not snow white, what does that indicate that has gone on?
In my opinion, I believe that the gold has still gold oxides in it, particularly if it's gold. With other metals, yes, they very much go black when they're an oxide, particularly platinum. So you'll actually see black specks of platinum in the precipitate. And if you do see them, you know, don't even try to go any further. Just actually drain off the above solution so you're left with the precipitate and start again. Put in your hydrochloric acid and start putting in the hydrogen peroxide again and break it all down again.
And then
okay.
once you've got this white precipitate, what do
okay,
you do with
yes.
that?
Okay. If you have had to go around a second time with the hydrogen peroxide, when you see the actual precipitate breaking down and going back into the solution as it's chloride again, keep adding the hydrogen peroxide for a good 10 to 15 minutes afterwards to make sure that it all disassociates back into the solution. So even when you can't see it anymore, just keep going. so it all disassociates. However, once you do get the snow white precipitate, I generally just drain off the top solution. At that time, because I have precipitated it at about 11 to 14 on the pH, depending on which metal I'm working with, I generally go up to 11 with gold, but with molybdenum, which seems to be a lot stronger at bonding with hydrogen in a matter, it takes, you need to take the pH up to about 14 before it all drops out. But once you have got it all dropped out, basically I wash it by draining off the solution and running natural spring water over it about 7 or 8 times. And after about the 7th or 8th time, I test the pH of the water. If it's below a pH 8.5, I consider it washed. If it's still above a pH of 8.5, I keep washing it. I keep draining off the water, adding new water, stirring it around, letting it settle, drain off the water, and repeat.
What is the difference in the effect of these different elements? You're the only person that I know of that's made molybdenum ormus.
That's actually a very good question. I can honestly say I've done pretty much all the platinum group elements. They were actually quite psychoactive, to be honest, and I'm not overly happy with ones that are terribly psychoactive because they seem to disrupt my thought patterns. I prefer ones that make me feel good. That's why I quite like tin and copper and metals most people wouldn't touch, because those ones actually make me feel good. Make me feel alive rather than disoriented.
Mm-hmm.
You said you have done lead.
Correct.
And, you know, there's never been much discussion about lead other than it's extremely toxic and harmful. You are making a white powder ormus of lead?
Yes, that is.
Or have
correct.
Done?
Yes.
And have you experienced with ingesting it?
Yes.
And no problems?
None.
I remember two or three years ago on the list we talked about lead, and there had been some discussion that you could make ormus out of lead, but most people are very, very afraid of it because of the general attitude that lead is, you know, under any conditions, not good for you.
Okay. Do you understand what makes a metal toxic?
Not fully, no.
Okay. The only reason particular metals are toxic is because they have free hydrogen bond open valence electron cells around the edges of their clusters, makes them highly reactive. So when you ingest them, the free radicals in your body have to combat that, and it drains your body of the free radicals. That's why you get poisoned.
Okay.
The idea behind an ormus of lead is there isn't these free valence electrons. That the goal being is, from what I understand, is that they should all be paired, and that removes
right.
its toxicity.
So it makes it totally stable?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, the last part, once you have your fully washed precipitate, you've rinsed it with fresh spring water many times until the pH is 8.5 or less. I generally then drain off the water and then put it in a beaker and heat it up for a while. On my element, I set my element to about 120 degrees Celsius, which is enough to pretty much make the beaker glow. Not quite glow, but, you know, it starts to get a bit orange. And I actually let the precipitate dry out quite a bit in there and let it gain a lot of that heat. And I leave it on that for about 3 to 4 hours. And then I actually like to get a strong spirit, alcohol spirit. I prefer to use the surgical spirit that you can buy from pharmacy stores. It's an ethyl alcohol. I mix a small amount in the ethyl alcohol, and then I precipitate it a second time and wash it a second time. I just feel more comfortable that way because I know
that when I dissolve it in the ethyl alcohol, any leftover metals that might still be there won't dissolve into the ethyl alcohol, but the ormus will. And then when you separate that ethyl alcohol and re-precipitate it, I know, that, well, at least I feel more certain that there will not be any heavy metals left.
Do you ever find any residue that doesn't dissolve in the ethyl alcohol?
Rarely. It depends on the metal.
What's most likely to find?
Copper. Copper. Copper seems to be one of the hardest ones to work with, and I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
It just is one of those really stubborn metals.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way of putting it. It's stubborn. Really stubborn.
Jim says that he has actually run a magnetic trap on the air, and he gets largely silver and copper from the ormus in the air.
That really wouldn't surprise me. I suspect that it was probably run at night time.
Yeah, I don't know when he ran it.
The reason I say that, the sun is has an extreme gravitational pull on it. You just can't imagine how much gravitational pull it has. You know, the only thing that would be more than that would be a black hole, which is basically extremely dense matter. But the sun has a huge gravitational pull. And between us, between Mars and Jupiter, there is an asteroid belt. And then outwards further, there is a second asteroid belt out past Pluto. It's like way past Pluto. The sun actually draws particles from those meteorites and that brings them in towards the sun. So at night time, when we're facing away from the sun, these particles are actually coming towards us.
Hmm.
And then when they hit the atmosphere, they are traveling at very high rates,
mm-hmm.
and they burn up. And to me, that's very much what we're doing with the hydrogen peroxide. We're burning up the metal. And then the metals become such tiny individual ions in the air that if you have a correctly configured trap, you should be able to extract them. That's why I feel that that type of air trap would work better at nighttime than it would during the daytime.
Mm-hmm. That would be an interesting experiment to try.
Yes, it would.
Now,
so I would also suspect that it would work during the daytime, just not as efficiently as what it would at nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally new information for me, Michael. That's bloody interesting.
Sorry? Oh, okay.
It's totally new information for me. I haven't seen that.
Well, I know that dew is collected at certain times of the year and so on, and that dew will have a lot of ormus in it as well and a lot of alchemical properties.
Yeah.
And dew is generally a nighttime or early morning phenomenon.
However, I will say that those ions that have been burnt up and come through the atmosphere will still be in the air during the day, just in less amount than what there would be at night.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because...
what you're saying is that most people are not thinking about the tremendous influence that the sun provides.
Oh, yes. Yes, very much.
Well, my point exactly. I mean,
the sun is its own alchemist. I mean, it's converting helium into
hydrogen
all the time. However, it has a huge gravitational pull. And particles from out in the cosmos are actually heading towards the sun. And the sun uses them as well to continue its nucleonic reaction. But those particles at nighttime, we're in the road between the outer cosmos and the sun. So they hit our planet at a rate of, I think it's, Sigberto, you said it was like 40,000 tons a year?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, dust particles. You know, I've spoken with many geologists, and they just clearly do not understand this either. You know, you go out into the desert areas and you see the sedimentation I said, okay, so like, what is settling here? And they don't have a clue. But really what it is cosmic dust over many, many years that creates the sedimentation on the mountains and plains and areas of the earth. It's actually sunlight that's condensed.
So the other thing is I posted on the message board about cloud formation. Hydrogen and oxygen, which forms water, won't actually condensate into a drop until it can find a nucleation point, or that the density, or should I say humidity, of the water reaches 7 times normal nucleation of water droplets. So clouds would not even form if it were not for this cosmic dust coming down onto the Earth.
Right.
Because it's that cosmic dust that allows the water to find a nucleation point to form a cloud, and then it reaches enough humidity that it rains. That's why rainwater is actually extremely good to use as well, as long as you're out in country areas.
I'm amazed at how similar clouds look from above them to the precipitate as you're precipitating it out.
Yes, they do look like little tiny clouds at times. Particularly after you've used the distilled white vinegar and you're precipitating it the second time.
Mm-hmm.
Then, it does very much look like clouds.
So have you observed any unusual physical properties of these materials, the different elements? Do they respond differently to magnetism? Do they have weight that is different from the weight that you would expect it to have, etc.?
I'm going to have to say I haven't spent a lot of time looking into those things. I look more in towards how the alchemists of old used to make their stone, and how the chemical processes actually work, rather than actually studying the end result. I don't spend a lot of time studying the end result. One of the ones that I did, which I did find rather peculiar, was fermentation of dew water, which forms the brown gur at the bottom. And then you put that into a test tube and you keep it in your incubator for a good 6 months and it turns white. When you dry that white powder out, it is exactly like, on Barry's side, it's like fly ash. You can't, as soon as you put your hand near it, it flies away. It tries to move away from your hand. You can't put anything that's got any electrical field, like even a mobile phone, you bring near it, and it tries to go away from it. It's like it repels all radio frequency magnetic forces of all types. It's actually extremely hard to handle as well. So when it is at that white stage, just getting the leftover water out of that test tube is actually quite tricky, because as soon as you put your hand near it, the white powder at the bottom suddenly goes to the top, so you can't get the top off the test tube. So you actually got to hold the top of the test tube so it hits to the bottom, so then you can put a pipette in there and get the water out.
Now, Michael, do you think that is pure mineral, or do you think there's some biological or EM-type substances in it?
No, I do believe there are EM-type substances in there.
Hold that EM, please.
Effective microorganisms. They're biological cell-type animals, in a manner of speaking. They are particularly...
Animal matter versus... or plant matter versus pure mineral.
Yes. They are particularly unique. One of the things I did was a process with blue-green algae, and it was only after I did some more research on blue-green algae did I actually find out how they actually work. The process they use is actually a process that involves superconduction. The hydrogen proton is absorbed into them whilst the electron goes around the outer cell, and that's how they create their ATPs that they use to grow. Now, there is only one substance I know of that can provide that type of superconduction.
Mm-hmm.
And when you process blue-green algae, they are
actually very high in pardon me, in rhodium. They are extremely high.
Can translate ATP,
high.
Please?
ATP is like a sugar.
Yeah.
In order for the cell to grow, it produces a sugar.
Yes.
And the way it produces the sugar is it absorbs a hydrogen proton whilst the electron goes around the outside of the cell. And then at a certain point, there's like a, it looks like a hook, where it joins together the hydrogen protons and oxygen atoms to form sugars so it can grow. It's actually very unique.
Did
but the
spend...
outer cell structure is predominantly rhodium.
Wow.
But it's not rhodium metal. It's very unique.
And, now, since rhodium is so bloody expensive, I guarantee there's a huge fascination on this list on how to get all these incredible, multiple rich sources of rhodium and turn it back into the metal.
Oh, actually, that process isn't as complex as one would think. I guess because I've been around the electroplating industry, I know how to recover metals from the solutions that we use for electroplating, particularly the gold tank. I mean, when the gold tank gets its gold salts around the edge, I mean, we sit there and actually scrape off those gold salts and then recover the gold from them because it's actually quite a lot of money there. And electroplating is not one of the most richest companies to be involved in. They are actually quite expensive to run, particularly with all the chemicals. So yes, you can actually process the blue-green algae in much the same manner as you would process any vegetable matter. I posted on the list how to process tree sap, but you can process blue-green algae in the exact same method and actually extract the rhodium or the mineral content of the blue-green algae. And then once you have that white powder of the blue-green algae, you can then mix it into glycerin and run it through an activated carbon filter, and the metals will reform on the carbon plate. Or you can put it in a cyanide-based solution and electroplate it out, just like you would with just about any platinum group element metal.
When you
Excuse
did
me?
The stuff that levitated away from the fly ashy stuff,
yes?
You sent me. Did you send me a video of that?
No.
Have you ever tried to take a video or do a video of that? That would be an amazing video to show.
Well, now that you mention it, I have been trying to get some documentation together.
Mm-hmm.
But I just had completely underestimated the amount of time that's needed to get this type of documentation together. That's why
mm-hmm.
I have great admiration to people that do put this type of documentation together. You just don't realize how many hours go into it. The document I'm just about finished at the moment is actually the process I do with the Horizon Salt, and I'm hoping to get that up to the list as soon as I can.
Mm-hmm.
There are at least 30 photographs I've taken that are going to be included in that document showing the actual process being done.
Do you have
I'm
any
hoping
of the fly
a document
stuff
of that
all?
Nature. Sorry.
Do you have any of the fly ash stuff around?
Hang on. Yeah, I'm just looking. I'm just looking. I have some GER going there.
Do you have any of it that's in the fly ash state?
Not at the moment, no.
Might you have it by the time you do your next get-together in Sydney?
Unlikely. The thing is, it takes many months.
Uh-huh. Well, here too would be something that I would suggest is that
I do have dew water here that is fermenting at the moment. There's probably about 8 or 9 grams of GER that is collected on the bottom at the moment. I'd need to separate that, which I was planning to do in a couple of weeks, and then put that into my little test tube here.
What I would like to suggest is that you recruit some help next time you're at that point. Get some people to document it, videotape it, record it on a digital camera, that sort of thing.
Okay. Actually, one of the things I do plan this year is cleaning out my garage and setting up a much better table than the one that I've got now.
to allow people that are in the Sydney area to be welcome to come to my house and actually either help or participate in actually doing these types of processes.
Great plan, yes. Good idea.
I'm coming down to do that.
Yes. But I do still have a lot of work of cleaning out my garage. I've got so much. And I want to build a table along the back wall.
It doesn't take long to get cluttered, I tell you. Michael, I was going to ask you another question, and that is that when you're working with these metal precipitates and you're letting them sit, do you find that sometimes there are bio formations that form in the solutions? I mean, like something like almost like living matter.
Not that I have seen in any of the processes I've done with metals, but with the fermentation of dew water, yes, you do see that.
I haven't known really what to do with it, but you've given me some ideas this morning. But especially when I'm working with rhodium, I find that if you let the rhodium sit in the chloride solution for a while, a living, almost pulsing, jelly-like stuff begins to form in the solution, and it's coming out of the air.
Okay.
Excuse me?
Sorry, when you say you leave it for a while, would that be a few weeks, a few days?
More than a month.
Yeah, that's what I thought. See, I've seen things similar to that when fermenting the dew water. But
yes,
with the precipitates I do with the metals, they don't sit for any longer than 2 days.
Uh-huh.
I guess I'm just not letting them sit there in that state for long enough.
Kevin down.
But anyway, I'm very interested in this material. I just don't know what it is. And I'm sure it has some good function, and I don't know yet. I'm still going to, you know, do some more testing on it, but it's almost like life begins in this solution.
Kevin, down
it's not
in
an algae. It's not an algae because it's clearer, but it's almost like a jelly that forms inside the solution.
Yes, did
Kevin,
you read up on the? Sorry, someone else.
Kevin down in Castlemaine has been experimenting using a chemical trap, trapping Ormus out of the air. He uses a very toxic compound of copper, and he gets a crystal that forms, and most of the crystal is a deep blue, but on the edges it's more toward the yellow, and he will clean that out and put it in a jar, and living things will grow in this very, very toxic material because there's so much Ormus that came out of the air into it. I have a video of him describing this. Michael, I'd like to see you communicate with Kevin a bit because he's done some amazing alchemical work and documented it pretty well.
Oh, good. Very good. Like I said, I have great admiration towards people that put in the extra mile to document it because firsthand I'm learning just how many hours it takes. It's actually very time-consuming.
One thing I'd love if you're able to speak to this for a moment, Michael, and that is for the people who are listening on this call, most of them haven't got anywhere near even the physical setup to be able to do some of the stuff that you're doing. Would you just briefly describe your physical setup? Like, for instance, this heating element. What are the dynamics of that heating element, and where is it possible to get it? And the kind of equipment you've got, just your basic stuff, before you have to get into any specialty items, to set up. And, you know, like I've got a spare table in my garage. What should I have on it?
Okay. I do know a glass blower who has made me some custom equipment, but I won't touch on that because that's very specialist sort of stuff. Of the more basic equipment, a metal stand
which you get from, like, florists that they put vases on. I mean, they're perfect because under the metal stand candles, those oil-burning candles, the 9-hour ones, they're actually very useful. I have boxes of them. A spice. Okay, well, Dennis was asking me about what equipment I've got on my table, and I think I got up to the bit just before I dropped out where I said the spice rack with the glass spice bottles was quite good for holding things. And then I was about to say I travelled around to quite a few homeware shops and picked up glass vases, cylindrical glass vases. One I have is 1.2 metres tall and about 25 centimetres round. I do some large precipitations in that one. And I know most people say not to use glass when doing a sodium hydroxide precipitation, but I found out that sodium hydroxide needs to get to a pH greater than 14 before it starts attacking glass, unless you rub the glass. So the goal is, if you are going to do it in glass, which isn't entirely recommended, but should you do go down the glass route, as long as you keep the pH less than 14 and that you don't rub the edges of the glass, it should be okay. And it seems to work quite well for me.
What do you mean by rub the edges of the glass?
Well, when you're stirring the solution, generally with, you know, a wooden spoon or stick of some sort.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't rub the stick against the edge of the glass.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Otherwise, you start etching the glass.
Okay, good.
I have one glass here where I've actually done that, and it's etched all around the edge of the glass, and it's actually quite clear to see. And I'm just going to polish that out and then reuse it, but it can actually happen once you get to the higher pH ranges.
All right.
What do you use for a separatory funnel?
Sorry?
What do you use for a separatory funnel?
Oh, I use a siphon. Just rubber tube siphon with a long piece of hard plastic garden type. What are those gardens? They have those long black tubes. I connect one of those black tubes to the end of a clear rubber hose and literally just siphon it. It's quite simple.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hold it to the edge of the flask with a clothes peg. I mean, really high-tech stuff here, you know, clothes pegs. As for the heater element that I have, I bought that from a homeware shop. It's just basic standalone type kitchen stove heater element. Nothing terribly special about it, except this particular one was digital. So it cost about $120, I think. It was fairly expensive. The non-digital one I saw for about $35, and the portable gas one, which I saw, was $25. So I bought one of the portable gas ones as well, but the portable gas one only burns for about 9 hours, and then you've got to replace the gas bottle.
Hmm.
And the gas bottles are about $1, so it's not a big deal. What else have we got here? I got a lot of...
With the heating element,
yes?
You have a bucket of sand on top of it, so I presume that with the fluctuations of the digital heating mechanism, it'll sort of turn on and maybe heat up to the right temperature and turn off for a few minutes, so there'll be a fluctuation of temperature.
Yes.
I presume the sand keeps the temperature stable.
Correct. That's the goal.
And is it a steel bucket?
Yes.
That will give you some magnetic shielding. Jim always had to have some kind of a steel on top of his electric hot plate in order for the magnetic shielding.
Yeah, and in the case of my particular bucket, it's actually stainless steel.
Ah.
It actually was being sold. Sorry.
Say again?
How large is your bucket?
Oh, this one is about 30 litres. I don't know how much that is in gallons.
That's 8 gallons.
Yeah. 8 gallons. So it's reasonably
large. Is your tractor completely up for sand?
Yes, it is filled with sand to about 4 or 5 inches from the top.
All right.
And
so you'd have quite a few things in that bucket in various stages of the process.
Oh, yeah, it can fit quite a few things. The Erlenmeyer flask, though, is actually quite large, so when it goes in on its own. The Erlenmeyer flask is a 4-litre one, so it's actually quite big.
Would you please translate
that?
That's
about 1.5 gallons.
What's an Erlenmeyer flask?
It's a it's a cylindrical flask. Tapered to the top, so it looks like a cylindrical pyramid.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay?
Yeah. And what's the purpose of that?
Oh, for this particular purpose, it's for fermentation, because the fluids actually break down and expand and release their gases as they do it, which then precipitates again from the top back down onto to what's fermenting. The Erlenmeyer flask leaves enough small room for the gas while keeping a large volume of liquid down the bottom.
Do you cap off the flask?
Do I cap it?
Mm-hmm.
As in seal it?
No, cover the top, because it's wide at the bottom and it comes up to a point. Then it has the stem, right, or short stem?
Correct. Yes.
So then do you cap that off, cover the top?
Yeah, it's filled. I have a glass Pyrex. The actual flask came with the Pyrex stopper
lid
that you just put on top. And then around the edge of that stopper, I use doping wax, used by gem cutters.
So then
to actually seal the top.
Seal it.
Yeah, fully air sealed.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And then, I bury that into the sand. The doping wax is actually very good because it's very strong and lasts quite a long time, and you can reuse it.
And it won't just melt?
No, it won't melt very easily. You have to actually hit it with a blowtorch to get it to melt. It's actually quite hard to melt.
Right.
Mainly because jewel cutters use the same wax to hold a jewel to the end of a rod while they cut it on the cutting machine. And the cutting machine is actually a grinder, so the jewel gets hot while they're grinding it. So this is a very specialist type wax. And lapidary clubs sell it, and there's one not far from me where I get it. It's only $7 and lasts forever. But it is a high melting temperature wax. So considering it's only in a sand pit, literally, of 37 odd degrees, it's normal wax would probably do. It's just I prefer to use this wax because it's easier to handle.
Okay, and what was the next on your list?
Okay, various dropper bottles, always useful. Stainless steel pots, preferably ones that have stainless steel lids and no protruding rivets or anything. You know, ones that are actually properly welded together with good stainless lids as well. Then there's the stainless.
And what do you use those for?
Sorry?
What do you use those for?
I use the stainless steel pot for actually doing calcination. Calcination is where you actually put the powder or whatever material you are going to literally roast. You put it inside the pot, put the lid on the pot, and then put it on the burner at full steam and literally burn it to ashes. And the first time you do it, the ashes will be black. And then you just use a pestle and mortar, grind up the ashes, and put it back on the burner and burn it again. And repeat the process many times until the ashes are white.
And that's going to produce a lot of smoke.
Yes, I generally do it on the portable one outside.
And here come the fire machines.
Your neighbors think you're doing a Barbie all the time?
Yeah, that's it. They just think I'm a terrible barbecue person and generate a lot of smoke. my other incubator here is a fish tank. It's just a small tropical fish tank. It's about a foot and a half long by a foot wide by probably a foot and a half deep. It is your fairly typical tropical fish tank. Inside that, it's got a tropical fish tank heater, and I use that as a water bath. So for things that need to be fermented in a water bath rather than the sand pit, different things ferment differently. If you're processing vegetable matter, I found the water bath to work much more efficiently than the sand pit incubator. I don't know why, it just seems to work better. And with the water, tropical water fish tank heaters, you can finely control the temperature. Again, the heater is digital, and I can control it to 0.01 of a degree, because tropical fish is apparently really fussy, and they die if there's like 0.5 degrees difference or something. What else? There's a bunch of Pyrex glassware that I've got, different beakers, test tubes, test tube holders. Oh, yeah, here's one. This is my Bilton honey. One of my favorite tasks is to make the tincture from honey. It's the exact same process as you would do with any vegetable matter. You firstly lightly distill it, then keep that aside. Then you more heavily distill it at much higher temperature, and then keep that part aside. Then you take what's left, put it in the pot, go outside and roast it to ashes. Once you have finished roasting it to ashes, you bring the ashes back. You pour in the first very light distillate on top of the ashes, and then put that into the water bath for about 6-7 weeks. Then you separate, you take it out of the water bath, and then you put in the second distillation and goes back into the water bath for another 6-7 weeks. And then I generally add some distilled water, give it a good shake, back in the water bath for another week, and then take it out, separate out the water, and then precipitate that with sodium hydroxide and get the white powder of honey. It's actually very nice.
I've got to have some of that. What do you suspect it's composed of?
Well,
any element that you have an idea it might be composed
of? I would say flower pollen. The types of minerals that are in flower pollen are generally copper and tin.
Do you use raw honey?
Well, I buy it from a guy up in the mountains who literally takes it out of the beehive and sticks it in a jar, so I would say yes.
Yes. Yes.
Well, see, I'm very lucky. I live right next to the Blue Mountain. It's literally a 20-minute drive from where I live.
So do I.
Well, there you go. And, up in Bilpin, up in the mountains there, there's a guy that actually sells his honey. It's called the Cottage Orchid on Bell's Line of Road. And it's actually extremely nice, not just nice on toast, but it's also quite nice to process. All right, what else have I got here? I've got bags and bags of different crystals, rose quartz, milky quartz, clear quartz, hematite, what else?
Do you have any livestock syringes?
Yeah, just a few standard plastic syringes.
I found that they're very useful.
The digital pH meter, some pH papers, a very large tea strainer. There's the hydrogen peroxide, hydrochloric acid, sulfuric acid, nitric acid. My baking dish, glass baking dish, that's actually really good fun. If I take the sea salt precipitates after I've done my usual method, I put it in the baking dish, put the baking dish lid on top, again seal it with the doffing wax, and it's actually easier if you put the doffing wax on the lid and keep it all nicely heated up and melted and then just press the lid on. And it goes airtight and it's wonderful. Then you just let it sit for a day and it goes hard. Put that on a very gentle candle heat for about 42 days, and the amount of precipitate in the baking dish will double and turn to butter. And it is very much like a butter. However, during that process, on about the 39th to 40th day, the actual precipitate grows up like small volcanic mountains inside the baking dish. It looks like someone's done a sculpture of a round island of volcanic mountains. And in the middle of each of these little volcanic mountains is like a little dip where there will be yellow oil. And if I separate out that yellow oil and put it into a small test tube and just leave the test tube open and just lightly covered with a coffee filter, put a rubber band around it with a coffee filter, and just let it sit there and dry over about a month, the resulting dust there tastes like sugar. Really nice.
Hmm.
And the only time I've ever had salt taste like sugar.
And so when you take this internally, Michael, when you take it internally, that stuff, does it produce any state change in your consciousness?
Yes. I'd have to say yes, it does.
Would you describe that for us?
Well, for me, if I have a good, strong formus like that one, my third eye opens up, like, completely. And if I just sit relaxed in a chair, in a chair with my eyes closed, it's like being awake inside a dream where you can see full three-dimensional images just being broadcast from, I don't know where they come from. And I travel to different places. And occasionally, when I travel to different places, words will have come into my mind and I can go and later search for them on the internet. And I actually put an example one in the Ormus and Spirit list, wondering if anyone else had done such traveling. But yeah, that's the type of effect.
And what was that?
Sorry?
And what was that?
Which one was it?
Yeah, that you put into the Ormus and Spirit list.
A few days ago, it was called Astral Travel and Dreaming.
Okay.
If you wish to go read it. I travel to places. Occasionally, I get words coming into my mind. I go and Google on these words, and I use the Google Images tab. And I can quite often find a photo of the place I was at. Even though I have no idea where that place was, nor have I ever been there.
Ah, so you've just got validation of your journey.
Yes. Self, it's what happens in the journey.
Precisely. It's an expanded energetic state. That's the result of your whole brain synchronization.
Thomas!
That's me.
Welcome, buddy. I haven't heard you on the call.
Well,
you've been lurking.
I've been silent.
Yeah. Just so you know, Michael, Thomas is one of our guests about 5 months ago.
Okay.
And
he's
often in our call and a welcome participant, too.
Oh, well, thank you.
Speak up, Thomas.
Your description online is very much like what I would describe the expanded states, the so-called out-of-body states, as taught at Monroe Institute. And the wonderful thing about that, it just gives you a sort of a roadmap of these out-of-body states. Robert Monroe wrote a series of books that describe it in great detail, and it just made me more familiar with it so that when I got out in those kind of states, I wasn't so disoriented. But I would agree it's the process getting there and the expansion and what happens internally and emotionally, if you will, that that's the payoff in that process.
Yes. I'd agree.
I'd like to ask what kind of heat. You were saying candle-type heat for this.
Yes.
And you mean like a chafing dish with a candle under it?
Basically, I use a metal stand and basically the 9-hour oil burner candles.
The blue flame things?
Yeah, the little white ones that you put in oil burners.
I'm not sure if I know what you mean.
They're also known as tea lights.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Like a chafing dish with a candle under it.
Yes.
How many of these things have you taken pictures of, Michael?
A few. Some I've already posted on the Ormus list. But not too many because my last digital camera I loaned to someone and they broke it. And I've only recently got a new one, and I'm still trying to get used to it because it takes huge photos.
Oh, yeah.
It takes me hours to crop them down.
Oh, yeah.
Don't you use Photoshop, Michael?
No, I haven't got Photoshop.
It's a really useful program to get because it crops things. I crop things in literally a minute.
Okay. I should look into that. I just really haven't had the time to look into that.
Well,
what
I'm thinking is it might be helpful if somebody were to work with you on that. There may be some volunteers in the Sydney area.
Sure. Always open to help.
In fact, I'm coming down a couple of days before our little meeting on the 4th. I'd love to be able to come out for a couple of days. I'm going to be staying at Dr. Jen's. I'll just rent a car and come on out.
Oh, mate, just give me a call. I'll come and get you.
Or
don't need to rent a car.
Take Jen over there and both of you take cameras and do a photo documentation little trip.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll be in that.
Yeah, I don't mind.
So listen, apart from the interruption, we're up to about 2 hours now. And I don't like to do a call more than 2 hours. And when we had the interruption to the call, because Michael's about halfway through the kind of stuff that he could tell us about. And what I'm thinking of doing is a Michael Burberry Part 2 as a mid-month call. Is anyone into that?
Absolutely.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
That wasn't much of a response.
It's unanimous.
Yeah, okay, it's done. We'll do a Michael Burberry Part 2 call as a mid-month call, yeah? And let's just call it a day. It's a day!
Well done, Dennis.
and we'll continue in 2 weeks' time in our Ormus Sunday service, Part 2, Sunday in Australia, of course.
Can somebody put the instructions for the honey Ormus online with the list?
I'll be happy to. I'll do that next week.
Thank you. I don't have sound on my computer, so it kind of stinks right now.
Okay.
I have to really get a new computer, I think. That's what it's going to come down to.
And, Dennis, one thing I was going to ask.
Yes, mate.
Is if anyone was interested in the internet chat, where you go into a room and you just type.
Oh, hell yeah. I think that would be of great value. And,
okay.
In fact, in Skype, you can have little audio conferences.
Okay.
I'm still getting that sorted out.
I think they limit you on how many people can get in a room on Skype, don't they?
Yeah,
that's why I was thinking just an IRC, which is free. It's internet relay chat. The program to access it is called MIRC, M-I-R-C. It's also free. It's available for every platform. But
yeah, and you can get MIRC through Firefox too. They have their own MIRC.
Yes. And it's free, and it's just typing. So you can take your time. You can join the room and exit the room whenever you feel like it. And I thought it might just be a little easier or possibly a little cheaper than conference calls.
Well, there's Another friend of mine also does audio and type conferences, and I'll pick his brains about how to set that up.
Okay.
So we'll be able to have a let's say you have you as a presenter, and someone will be able to type in a question. You'll be able to go, ah, oh, I'll address that.
Yeah. Also, give me a chance to go and look in my books.
Yeah. Right.
Rather than trying to remember it all off the top of my head.
That extra small. Double typewritten space that you have, that book that I saw.
I got three of them now.
Just so you guys know what I'm talking about, when I first met with Michael, he showed me this notebook he had, which was like two handwritten lines per line on the book, and extra cramped, tiny writing, just stuffed full of data, and it almost made me dizzy just to look at it.
So, Michael, I'll bet you there's somebody in Sydney who would be interested in volunteering to scan that document and transcribe it.
Yeah, well,
if you're willing to share it.
Yeah, most of it I could share it without any issues. Some parts I probably wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the important parts are the definitions of each symbol that you come across in alchemical tracts.
Yeah.
Because there's well in excess of probably 12,000 symbols that you will come across if you go into that type of research.
Well, listen, let's just touch on that in our next call.
Okay.
Because we're over 2 hours now, and as you said before, when we connected between calls, Michael, you're hungry and so am I, and we'll just do Michael Burbley part two in 2 weeks, same place, same channel, same station, different day, better vibe.
Gotcha.
And I'll try and download this camera and crop the photos and get some more of them up on the Ormus list.
Cool. Excellent. Good. Cool. Anything else anyone wants to say before we go? Before we go? Before we go?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. We give our collective thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Dennis. It's a pleasure.
Very interesting.
So it's over and out, guys.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Happy New Year.
See you soon.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye.